Good evening, you all. I'm K2, Kilowatt. I'm Kilo 2, Romeo India Whiskey, and my name is Dick. You'll also hear Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick attempt to act as a net control, interlocutors, whatever, for this, we believe, educational process called the technical net. Lots of brain power exists in the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. This repeater has moderately good coverage of portions of those states. The subjects that are discussed on the TechNet are not necessarily planned most of the time. They are the subjects that you guys bring by way of the questions that you ask. So it's your show in that respect. For those who sign in during the first hour, we make a sincere attempt to at least give a brief description of an answer for your question during that hour. Beyond that hour, we get into the deeper subjects. But before we get there, at approximately 9 o'clock, Mel goes to his mailbag where people just getting their ham license or don't yet have a piece of equipment they can talk to us with have questions, and we make an attempt to give them an answer. We don't necessarily promise that we're going to give free consulting service in writing to people who just write to Mel and me. That's not what we promise. What we do promise is to make a sincere effort in live, real-time voice communication like this to give you at least a partial answer. Beyond the mailbag, Paul, WS2N, our space expert, will tell you the latest on what NASA and the cosmonauts have been doing. And there's always some exciting things going on with reference to new planets being discovered, exoplanets. And we're already up to something like 400 or 500 planets around other stars. And we're starting to discover more and more of them that are a little bit more Earth-like. And so it's just a matter of time before Earth-like planet or ones that are capable of supporting biological life are discovered. We're just at the beginning of that particular project. And so a lot of good information is going to follow. When you've got, let me drop. When you've got a 10 to the 10 or 10 to the 12, let's say 10 to the 11 average number of stars in a galaxy, and the observable universe has approximately 10 to the 11 galaxies put all together, and 10 to the 22 stars that are in the observable universe. If only one per million had a planet, only one per million of those had desirable characteristics. Let's see, that would be 10 to the 12 away from 10 to the 22. You'd still have 10 to the 10 planets with life on them, you know what I mean? The mathematics is huge. When you got that much possibility, there's a universal law of physics stating that if you have enough matter interacting for a long enough period of time, every single reaction that is not forbidden is compulsory. So, as you can tell, I'm convinced there's life out there. Alrighty, I just came back from a trip at a conference, which I may be telling you guys about, where I was away for 3 days. Let's see, what else are we going to plan tonight? That's more than enough. A person signs into the technical net because he does have a question or a comment by giving us his call letters, his name, his or her call letters, name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. You need not sign in just because we're listening, because you're listening. After 29 years, this is the 29th year, September of 1982 is when it started, you're listening to the beginning of TechNet number 1,367 of the series that began in September 1982. After 29 years, we believe there are people listening. We don't have to be convinced of that anymore. So we would favor the people who do have a question or a comment. So give me a call letters and name and that word yes right now. K2LIW listening.
And the answer YYY. Joe. Yes.
KC2ZQJ. Dave. Yes.
We've got Joe and Dave in that order. Zebra Quebec Juliet and Romeo Yankee Yankee. Okay, anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name, and that word yes at this time.
S2N, Paul. Yes, with the space report. Good evening, Dick.
Looking forward to that, Paul. And as these new planets are discovered that become more and more Earth-like, we'd like to hear more and more about that. Also, I believe that we're going to be hearing that three of the six people that are on the International Space Station have come back down to Earth. Because of the next launch is going to be bringing up more people. That would have been nine there temporarily, I'm guessing. And as such, we for 3 and 3 on the two Soyuz rescue craft that are presently on the International Space Station. There's no way to get the third group down if anything went wrong. I'm guessing it's got part of what's going on there. Alrighty, anyone else assigning, give me your call letters and name at this time, K2RIW. Okay, maybe more people will sign in later. We got more than enough to get going right now. Joe, number one, you're number one on the runway, W-H-O-R-Y-Y, K2RIW. Go ahead, Joe.
Good evening, Dick, W-H-O-R-Y-Y. My question is in actually three parts, but they're quick parts. I'd like you to listen to all three parts before you answer anything. It's important. I had a piece of test equipment fail because of a component which took out several other components within the piece of test equipment. The question is, and it's here, three parts. A tantalum capacitor failed. I'd like to know the scientific reason why a capacitor like that seems to short, then open up. And it didn't take very much of a voltage, overvoltage to do that. Second part of that question is, how fast does a part like that seem to fail, or will it take an overvoltage surge of its rating by rating a millisecond or whatever? And number three, can I put something here across the power line of this device to prevent this possibly happening again, like a Zener diode? Go ahead.
Like you, Joe, I've had that exact failure. A Hewlett-Packard 85, 67, I think it was, spectrum analyzer, one that goes to about 20 gigs, a slightly older version than the 8566. Anyhow, I was using one of those spectrum analyzers 2 years ago, and it's developed a very mysterious failure. And nice thing about that particular spectrum analyzer is that when you take off the bottom cover, you've got a whole bunch of plug-in cards that are the individual power supplies, plus 15 and plus 5 and minus 15 and so on. Each one has a light-emitting diode indicating that the correct voltage is coming out, and each one has a test point at the edge of those cards. I rapidly found out which particular card was not putting out voltage, and it was a completely shorted tantalum capacitor. It was something like a 1 microfarad tantalum, 35 volts. The thing was in the vicinity of a little more than an eighth-inch in diameter and probably about half-inch long, with axial leads coming out of it, silver-plated, a silvery-looking object. Very, very common, high-quality tantalum capacitor. In that particular case, let me drop it. As you can tell, I'm giving you a personal testimony as a partial answer to your question, and that is that this particular capacitor became a dead short. That was one of the reference power supplies, and of course it disturbed a whole lot of other things in the spectrum analyzer. Because that tantalum capacitor was on the output of the regulated output of that power supply, and it was a 35 volt rated, and I think that was a 10 volts or a 12 volt supply. In other words, the tantalum itself is being used way below its ultimate capability, if you believe in the label on the side. It was a high quality brand, I don't remember which one it was right now, and because it was on the output of a regulator, in my opinion, it probably never saw a spike in voltage. As I checked with some of my people who are pretty savvy about servicing equipment, they tell me that that whole series of tantalum capacitors that were very popular on high-quality equipment, like Hewlett-Packard, when they approach numbers like 20 years of age, for no darn good reason, they all become short circuits, a high percentage of them. The recommendation, which I didn't take, from this well-qualified person was, take all of those capacitors on all of those individual printed circuit power supply plug-in cards and replace all of those tantalums, because it's just a matter of time before a couple more of them go on you and give you grief at the wrong time. That there's a certain age characteristic for those, and maybe the answer is 20 years, maybe it's 15, maybe it's 25, I don't know, but something in that vicinity, they go bad, and you and I can speculate that they saw an overvoltage and that created it. I see evidence that it doesn't require an overvoltage. On top of that, a capacitor like that, as long as you're not sustaining the overvoltage, can take ridiculous amounts of overvoltage. And I've seen people do that for brief periods of time. So overvoltage as a causative agent, I'm skeptical of. Just pure age.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
My next best guess is that pure age, because the chemistry that was understood in, let me pick a number, 1985 or so, the
chemistry of tantalum capacitors, the way they were constructed, the materials used, and so on, was such that they believed they had at least 25 years of age. They did artificial aging environmental tests, and I said, hey, this is more than enough quality that's required for this capacitor. Of what was known then, those capacitors now, I don't see them. That exact brand name, model, style, whatever, I don't see them anymore. As such, the world has moved on, and that method of construction is no longer being used. So I don't think it's abuse that's causing it, as you can tell. Now, anyone...
something?
Okay. Joe's going to be able to say something. I'm also going to pass it over to the net for anyone else who has knowledge on these particular tantalum capacitor failures. But Joe first. Go ahead, Joe.
Okay, before we get too carried away here. The capacitors that failed, or one failed on this particular module, one of my service monitors, had a rating of 6.8 microfarad at 15 volts, and it was being used on a 12-volt line, a regulated line. That's what made me think about the problem of getting the thing spiked with over voltage. One part failed, and there were two others on the same board that didn't fail. I took those parts out and replaced them with brand new parts anyway. And I tested those parts later, and they were good, and I purposely wanted to see what they took. And it didn't take too much more than 15 to 18 volts applied across them to make them short. You still didn't answer my original question. I was kind of curious of the scientific reasoning behind it, why it does go to a short. And then you can answer part C with something like a Zener's diode across the thing, help catch this and prevent this later on. Back to you.
Yeah, but in about 60 seconds, I'm about to throw it open to the net for anyone who has knowledge about tantalum capacitor failures. And I can tell Joe that you seem convinced that because the capacitor was rated to 15 volts and being used at, let's say, 12.4 volts, that's the reason for the failure. I'm skeptical of that. Yes, you and I, in our conservativeness, where we'd like to live a belt and suspenders kind of a life, we would like to have a 2-to-1 safety factor on the voltage rating as opposed to where they're being used. When it comes to the wattage of resistors, that's a very common rule. If you know you're going to be dissipating half a watt, you make sure it's a 1-watt resistor, if you know what I mean. In the case of tantalum capacitors and other kinds of capacitors, I think it's a little bit rare that a manufacturer will be so conservative that it'll make a 2-to-1 rating the safety factor. 12 volts on a 15-volt capacitor should be enough. I'm not convinced that the 12 volts is what's doing it. If that 15-volt rated capacitor was being used at 6.8 volts, although the failure rate might be a little bit lower, I still think that those particular tantalums would fail. I think it's one of the reasons that particular style of tantalum, from my experience, appears to be no longer available. We've moved on. We no longer build them that way with that chemistry. And so the method of failure probably is not too different with the chemistry that was understood then from what's going on with the lithium polymer batteries and lithium ion batteries and nickel metal hydride batteries and nickel cadmium batteries. All of these batteries, and even your lead acid battery in your automobile, have a finite number of charge and discharge cycles that they can tolerate. And rather rapidly beyond that rate, the total ampere hour capacity beyond that rate starts going down real fast. The chemistry starts changing, and you don't get infinite lifetime out of the majority of high-quality batteries we use. Tantalums are not that different from capacitors, in my mind, in the method by which they store energy. Now, let me first send it over. You can tell I'm not a tantalum expert at all, although I'm getting lots of people of lots of experience telling me that that style of capacitors, if you really want to make sure you get high reliability of the instrument, replace every darn one of them, because they're all going to fail, regardless of what ratings they had. So anybody out there with further information, their experience or whatever, on tantalum capacitor failures, please give us your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QIQ. WGP.
Okay, Glenn and John in that order. These are capacitor men from way back. Hey, Glenn, you've got lots of capacity. Tell me what you're using for high-quality capacitors. Tell me what you know about these failures and what your experience is. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, good evening, Dick, and good evening to everybody on the net tonight. Yeah, actually, in practice, this, Dick, right now, what we've kind of doing most of our new supplies and most of the new control circuitry is that we really avoid the tantalums, number one, mainly because of expense. The price of the tantalum capacitor today is like 10 times that of ceramics and aluminum electrolytics. So that's the first reason that we stay away from them. But they do have some very, very odd failure mechanisms associated with them. And a lot of that's due to the temperature characteristics of the tantalum capacitors. If you have a data sheet on most of the tantalums, they have very, very odd, you might see a temperature rating, but what will happen is if you look at the voltage and temperature, they shift quite a bit so that if you hit like 70 degrees C, you could literally be at half the voltage potential and capability on the capacitor. And the way that they fail, basically they do short circuit. That's one of the problems. Basically the metallization inside cracks, breaks down, and then causes a short circuit. That's as much as I know for now, Dick. Maybe if there's some other questions that you have about tantalums for me, K4IW, KC2QIQ.
I promised a couple of people that I'm going to wait a little bit beyond the four beep on a few occasions because I'm hearing complaints from people who want to sign into the TechNet by various other means than local repeater input, and they're having trouble doing it. So I'm going to be adding some extra delays from time to time. Apparently you've seen, and I should have seen, the graph of tantalum life and reliability versus temperature. I'm getting the impression from what you just said that if you had that curve in front of you, it's one of these situations where you're looking at life or voltage rating as a vertical axis of a graph, horizontal axis is thermal temperature is being subjected to, and I'm getting the impression that at some particular critical temperature, maybe it's near 100 degrees C, the curve suddenly skyrockets. Your voltage rating goes into the circular file, and the reliability or the artificial aging happens real fast. I'm speculating that that's what the curve looks like. If you've seen that curve, is that approximately what you've seen, Glenn? So thermal characteristics seems to be one of the strong points. I think the whole reason that tantalums were very popular 20 years ago is they were super compact. These tiny little capacitors had a large number of microfarad voltage product ratio in an extremely small package. In its day, it was great. We've apparently moved on. So that graph, does that graph have a skyrocket characteristic at a particular temperature, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW?
Yeah, absolutely, Dick. And the number's around 70 degrees. And most people are like, well, my shack is never around 70 degrees. But what's interesting is that even a piece of electronic equipment without a fan inside of it, and you put a thermocouple in near those capacitors, and you'd be surprised how close the temperatures get to that, just even at room temperature. It's kind of amazing. The other thing, too, is aluminum electrolytics have really taken a huge leap in terms of their life. With the load life of an aluminum electrolytic today, you can get them with 10 and 12,000 hours, which was completely not available even, 15 years ago, where the tantalum has basically had longer load life. Because a typical aluminum electrolytic would only have like 2,000 hours of life, load life, and the tantalums were properties have caught up in the aluminum electrolytics, of course, used with the ceramics. It's almost completely eliminated the need for tantalum capacitors. Like K4IW, KC2QIQ.
You just said a mouthful that I want to hear a little bit more about, and that is load life. If any of the capacitors we've used over the last 20, 30 years have a so-called load life of 2,000 hours, which is a very, very small number of years, and if I'm going to use that piece of electronics 24 hours a day, wow, those are terrible numbers. So what is load life? In other words, if I've got a very heavy ripple content to my particular schematic diagram such that the capacitor is really working hard, and each half cycle he's dumping a lot of charge in and out, is that one of the aggravating factors? Is that part of the so-called load life? If I've got a very gentle capacitor, just making sure that my op-amp doesn't break into oscillation because of the impedance of a power supply, is that really a heavy load life? And 2,000 now, it strikes me, is an extremely small number. What's going on here, Glenn? You're scaring me a little bit. KC2QIQ, K2IYW in the tech net.
Yeah, Dick, it's one of the primary failure mechanisms of most power circuits, and also, you know, quite a few other types of circuits. If you look at an aluminum electrolytic, open up a catalog, you can get, you know, UCC or any of the major ones, Rubicon, or any of the major manufacturers of capacitors of aluminum electrolytics, and you can look at the graphs and the specs on those parts, and you'll see that only the most expensive aluminum electrolytics have the higher temperature, the 105 degrees. You know, the typical aluminum electrolytic is an 85 degrees in capacitor. Junk. I mean, 105 is probably a fairly decent, you know, temperature range for an aluminum electrolytic. And you can go to the best ones, which are 125, but you can really pay a premium for those. Here again, load life basically is a capacitor that's operated at the maximum allowed ripple current and at or just below the maximum rated voltage and the maximum rated temperature. And then using those three items at their maximum, basically you could say that the older capacitors and even some of the cheaper newer ones would only last 2,000 hours max. But...
Now let me run that by you one more time. 2,000 hours scares the daylights out of me. A 1 year, 365 days, 24 hours a day, 8,760 hours. If my capacitor is only good in my particular service, because I'm a little bit crazy in the way I'm using it, is only good for 2,000 hours, that's 23% of a year. That's 2.7 months. You're telling me that if I put that capacitor in a power supply that's going to run 24 hours a day, on average, I'm going to, if it's a 2,000-hour rated capacitor, I'm having trouble believing anybody would sell anything like that today. At 2.7 months, I've got a 50% probability of failure. You can see where I'm going here. The mathematics are scaring me. Did somebody, when they wrote that data sheet, Glenn, slip a data point by 10 to 1, and so they said 2,000 hours, and they meant 20,000 hours. At least now I'm, you know, 1.5 years, although I'm still darn unhappy. I mean, I don't want that damn circuit to own me, where I've got to continuously be servicing the darn thing. I want to own it, and 2,000 hours dictates that it owns me. KC2QIQ. Calm me down here, Glenn. KC2QIW.
Welcome to my world, Dick. it's a problem. It seriously is. There's no decimal point in it. You will not find anywhere that I'm aware of an aluminum electrolytic with 20,000 hours of load life on it. If you did, I'd really appreciate it if you let me know. And besides, I work with enough capacitor manufacturers that if they had something like that, they'd be knocking on my door in a minute to try to sell it to me. But reality is that really the high-end ones are 10,000 hours. There's a fairly good number that's 7,000 hours. The little cheap ones. And another interesting thing for load life, Dick, is the diameter of the capacitors. When you get the really, really small, like 5-millimeter aluminum electrolytic, those ones you can almost guarantee are between 1,000 and 2,000 hours. Now, if they're just used with a limiting resistor and they're around an op-amp circuit and they don't have a lot of temperature rise around them to increase their temperature, they can last a fairly decent lifespan. But what happens today is in today's compact electronics, where people want to stuff these capacitors in with near power circuits, and when you turn it on, you feel the exhaust temperatures of 40-degree exhaust from a 25-degree C inlet. You can imagine there's components inside there that aren't dissipating power, but they're just getting warm next to the items next to them. That's going to put pretty darn close to that 85-degree C limit, and they're going to run out into load life in no time. And take those capacitors out, and you'll measure they're open circuits. There's virtually no capacitance on them at all. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Wow, am I getting eye-opening here. Okay, aluminum electrolytics. You're telling me numbers like 2,000 hours for a medium good one or 1,000 hours for a yucky one. Aluminum electrolytics sounds pretty bad. The old-fashioned tantalum sounds pretty bad. You're giving me lots of lists of small electrolytic capacitors, small volume, you know, a few microfarad-type capacitors. We're not talking about the computer-grade 40,000 microfarad type great big cans here. We're talking about the ones that are on our printed circuit boards. Aluminum electrolytics sound bad. Tantalum sound bad. Give me some good news. What brand of capacitors should I be using? And by the way, the lights that that Joe did experience, are you saying that the most likely he thought there was some kind of failure in the way the capacitor was being used? You make it sound like what he's experienced is normal life wear out for that particular component, and they should be failing. Over to you, Glenn. I'd like to hear some more about this. K2RIW.
KC2YDT, late check-in.
YDT recognized. Glenn, you got it.
Oh, good evening, Matt. Yeah, it just it is interesting that when you start looking at the failure mechanism, and keep in mind, these things are also statistically drawn data. When they look at what the minimum lifes are and load life capabilities, they are the bottom end of the curve. But you have to realize that that curve, if you're going to produce 100,000 pieces of something, your warranty life is going to be very, very short. And that's why generally when you look at things that are commercial grade, industrial grade, or actually let me restate that, consumer grade, industrial grade, and military grade, the types of components that you're going to use vary quite a bit. And also the load life capabilities, the capacitors that are used in those circuits are going to vary quite a bit. And, it's pretty obvious when you start taking a look at a capacitor catalog and know what to look for, looking at load life, looking at the voltage current rating. And there's ways of extending the life. In other words, you can basically double or triple the voltage capability of your capacitor. You can get higher load life and higher temperature capacities. And the other thing, too, is keep your capacitor in an area where it's immune from, from extreme temperatures. Not so much cold you don't have to worry about. I mean, granted, the capacitors will roll off, but they'll come back. Heat, it's an aluminum electrolytic's worst enemy, but K4NW, please.
I'm making sure I wait long enough. Okay, aluminum electrolytics don't seem to have much life. Tantalums don't have much life. If I really want to make sure that this circuit is reliable, and I'm going from the consumer grade to the industrial grade, and I'm willing to pay, in a couple of critical cases, I'm willing to spend the extra money for military-grade capacitors. What kind should I be using? I mean, what style of capacitors? Aluminum electrolytics are that bad, tantalums are that bad. For that kind of, let me pick a number, 6.8 microfarad, 2.2 microfarad, 1 microfarad, 35 volts. What kind of capacitor should I use if I'm a smarter person? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, to give you an idea, on control circuits, I basically stick to ceramics. I only use ceramics on control circuitry to make it last. If I want to guarantee 10 years of life, most of the time I'm just going to use ceramics anywhere in any control circuit. If I want my load life or my, my life expectancy of the circuit to last at least 10 years, I can still use the aluminum electrolytics. But basically what I have to do is I have to go back and look at the voltage rating, double them up, look at the current rating, double them up, go back and take a look at the temperatures that I'm running those capacitors at. If I can keep the ambient temperatures around those capacitors at areas where they're going to be low enough, I can meet the life. So if I have a 105 degree C capacitor and I keep it to 85 degrees C, I can virtually double and almost triple the life in some so I could have, let's say, 30,000, 30,000 to 50,000 hours. In some of the new LED driver circuits, where the LEDs will last 100,000 hours, we have drivers now that basically we can demonstrate 100,000 hours of reliability by just re-rating and sizing the capacitors and putting them in the right location.
Now, let me ask you a question that will put Joe's mind at ease. Where his particular capacitors might be, if it was like my situation, 25 years old. Do you believe Joe's tantalum electrolytic capacitors may have experienced normal old age wear out, that they weren't necessarily abused, that's approximately, he already is well into the extended life. He's into the retirement years of those particular capacitors. Is that possibly true, Joe? I mean, Glenn, go ahead.
Yeah, I can expect that. I mean, if I were to use, let's say, components that are just, consumer grade, and I tried to use it in an industrial type of application where, I'm expecting it's not always necessarily going to be air conditioned, and it's going to be run, you know, 24/7. Yeah, quite easily. We're out within 2 years. 4IW, KC2, QIQ.
Dick?
Question.
Joe, is that you who said my name?
Yes. It's hard to test W2YY. It's hard to test these parts, you know, for longevity versus time. But as I said, I replaced two other capacitors, the identical parts. It had three of them, three of the same parts on the board. One of them failed, two others didn't. And it just kind of, you know, hearing this conversation in the past, I decided to replace all three. Now, being that they were, you know, replaced, I didn't care if I damaged them anymore. And as I said, I put them on a power supply, and I think I only had to go up to about maybe 17, 18 volts. And they shorted, but they didn't short completely. Neither did the failed part. They only went to about 5 or 6 ohms across the capacitor. See, my problem is I'm trying to not have these things fail again if possible. That's why I asked you about the third part, about putting a Zener diode across these things to prevent these things from taking a spike near their, you know, maximum operating voltage. Back to you.
Question. John, we're going to get to you, and Wesley, we're going to get to you in that order. But first, the subject on the table right now is the Zener diode going to do it? I'm going to pass it over to Glenn, who's been in that field of high reliability power supplies with high capacity capacitors. You know, tantalum and electrolytic type capacitors. You've been there for a long time, Glenn, and we're going to try to tap your brain on this one. It is my guess, and you're going to confirm or deny or say I'm not sure, that Joe's speculation that overvoltage damage is the reason for the failure of his tantalum. I suspect that no, he's got normal wear out, and that putting a Zener diode across the capacitor is not going to give him the life he's looking for, the real life he's looking for. I'm speculating on that. I'll be passing that over to you for one of the questions, Glenn. Another question is that I'm having the impression from you, you got to keep them cool, got to buy the right brand name, maybe use ceramic, which you can really guarantee the life, but when it comes to tantalum-like electrolytics, if you really want more life and you insist on using that style, then if it's a 12-volt circuit, you better put in a 35-volt capacitor. What I think I'm hearing here, Glenn, a KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
You're right on the right track with that, Dick. That's exactly the procedure. And also, look at here's the three things that you really look for in a long to make a capacitor last a long time, especially when dealing with aluminum electrolytic. Look at the voltage rating, double it up if possible. Look at the temperature rating of the capacitor. A lot of capacitors in electronic circuitry is like 85 degrees C. Put a 105 in. You'll find yourself a lot more life there. And also look at the ripple current ratings on capacitors. If you can, you know, basically size up the capacitor to allow that to give you a little bit more life. Now, directly to Joe's question, will the Zener diode protect a tantalum capacitor? The answer is no way. The things that generally kill most of the tantalum capacitors is ripple currents. And it's just it's a load-like kind of a problem. So temperature, ripple currents, more than excessive voltages. If you were to put a Zener diode across it, yeah, it's going to protect. The main reason that I put Zener diodes in certain circuits are generally to protect the silicon. If I have a control IC, if I have something that's sensitive to voltage in that circuit, the Zener is a very, very fast-responding clamping device. So if I have a VCC in the circuit, I can put a 10-ohm resistor in series with a transorb or a Zener diode. I get a lot of transient protection for the silicon circuitry. But as far as the tantalum capacitor goes, I don't think you're really going to see any increase in life. I think you're just running into the life expectancy of those tantalums. And I think you did the right move by replacing them all. If you see other ones that are similar like that, just take them all, replace them, put in brand new ones. Back to you, Ben.
Thank you for all this, Glenn. I'm learning an awful lot. By the way, let me throw this in here, even though it hasn't come up yet. If somebody makes the mistake of putting a tantalum capacitor, that kind of capacitor, in your circuit, and installs it in reverse, so the negative lead is getting positive voltage, oh boy, you're in a heap of trouble. They really are intolerant of reverse voltage, and they literally, at some point downrange, like a half hour into use, will explode on that circuit and smear chemistry all over the place, and you're going to be damn unhappy and make shrapnel. So you got to be extremely careful with these capacitors. They don't get reverse voltage. Glenn also said another very pregnant subject. He entered another delicate subject, I better say, and that is when we're installing these capacitors, naively we say, well, we need something in the vicinity of 6.8 microfarad. I'm running the circuit at 12 volts. I'll put in a 15-volt capacitor. This is the way we lived in the past. Almost none of us look at the ripple current rating. And that circuit is going to be part of a power supply where it's going to be getting a continuous 120 cycles per second, a full-wave rectified 60-cycle current, and it's going to be dishing out an ampere of average ripple current. How many of us have ever looked at the ripple current of a capacitor we're installing? And think about it. Every capacitor you've ever used has got what you and I call power factor. To an RF person, you call it loss tangent. Whatever you call it, if you look at the current versus voltage in a cyclic manner, you measure the phase shift between the two. The only way, the only mechanism by which, let me drop this. The only mechanism by which you can have phase shift is either a shunt or a series resistor. There is an equivalent series resistor buried inside of that capacitor. You go beyond a certain ripple current rating for that particular capacitor, and the total amount of heating you're creating from that internal resistor that you didn't buy, you didn't see, you didn't think was there, is creating extra heating, which is eating into the life of the thing. Much of speculation on my part, hoping Glenn can confirm some of this. KC2QIQ, we're getting a brand new eye opening here. K2RIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, ripple current can be a problem, especially in a lot of circuits. Certainly power supply circuits are a big offender. But there again, digital circuits can also be some problems. Where I've seen some failures, especially motherboard manufacturers have had this problem when they first started putting switching power supplies on the motherboard. They were trying to make very, very low voltage circuits, like 1.5 volt supplies, 2.2 volt supplies on the motherboard from a 5 volt and a 12 volt source. And one of the first lessons that a lot of these motherboard manufacturers learned was that they were getting high. They thought they were putting DC in with nice DC regulators. They didn't have to worry about the ripple current. But their processors and other digital equipment had very, very large ripple currents being pulled by those processors. And they had to rethink. We had to basically educate them a little bit of how to select the capacitors for use with digital circuitry, Dick. In case where I just need KC2QIQ.
You just touched on another critical area here, Glenn. Those capacitors used in power supplies, in many cases, we're naively looking at the 60-cycle, 120-cycle rating. If that capacitor is being used in a switching regulator where it's running at 100 KC, for instance, and if I start rating the true capacitance of the capacitor as a function of applied frequency, and by the way, 100 KC square wave out of a switching regulator has a whole lot of 300 KC, 500 KC, 700 KC frequency components. All the odd harmonics of that original frequency are being subjected, capacitors being subjected to that. And you take an ordinary tantalum capacitor, for instance, which maybe has 1 microfarad at 60 cycles, and you rate it at 1 megahertz, it's not even a capacitor anymore. It's starting to become an inductor. Its loss tangent could be doing all kinds of things. It's a phase angle, which is what I'm looking for, power factor. So as you go to the higher frequency components of a switching regulator, again, I bet you're immediately jumping over to ceramic capacitors and you wouldn't even consider tantalum. Is that roughly true? Because I know there's a lot of ham radio operators who just throw in a tantalum capacitor on a switching regulator, and because on the schematic diagram, there's X number of microfarads on that piece of paper, and they think everything's hunky-dory, and I thought we're getting ourselves in a lot of trouble here. KC2QIQ, for a confirmation, K2RIW in the deck pad.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, a good sweet frequency for a lot of switching regulators is around the 100 kilohertz area, Dick. You'll find probably the majority of most switching power supplies are failed basically because of ease of the structure, how to build it, choice of component selection. 100 kilohertz is kind of a sweet number. And what you'll find is that the capacitors that are mainly used there still is a mixture between ceramics and aluminum electrolytics. but ceramics in very high frequency designs, you know, when we go up into the like megahertz, 500 megahertz switches, which I've designed a few, especially when they have to fit in really, really teeny tiny little places. Sometimes I'll get somebody who says, ah, can I get, you know, a 20 amp regulator and something about the size of a quarter? And be like, yeah, I can do it. But they pay for it. I mean, they got to pay the price, but I can do it for them. And I've actually, you know, had substrates made with a transistor, a ceramic capacitor built onto it, and give them a nice 12-volt, 20-amp regulator on something just about the size of a quarter. And it'll last over 10 years. It's amazing. But anything can be done, Dick, as long as the supply of money is there. K4IW, KC2QIQ.
As long as the man hours are allocated, as long as the money is there, and as long as the designer has the knowledge, you're describing things that are not clearly indicated in an awful lot of the methods by which we learn about power supplies. I'm also guessing that in many of your power supplies, there's an electrolytic capacitor for the low frequency component, and it is shunted by one, two, or three ceramic capacitors to tolerate the high frequency component. You don't want the tantalum capacitor to try to control all the low frequency, all the high frequency components. That's a guess on my part. Now, let me go over to John now. John? John's going to go first, and then Wesley in that order. John, I know that you've worked on a lot of really big power supplies. I bet you've seen some fancy capacitor failures, and I bet you've developed an awful lot of opinions on this. KC2QIQ. Here we go. KC2WGB. K2RIW. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Good evening, Dick. Everybody on the net. Yeah, Dick, I was going to say that I agree with Glenn 100% when it comes to tantalum and the heat structure, because in repairing equipment and the tests that I've done, I found that any of those tantalums that were near a higher heat source within the equipment, those are the ones that usually fail. And what Joe was saying is 100% right, because if you were to remove an old tantalum, you may blow it at 10% overvoltage. But if you take an exact replica, new, you can go to 50% before you'll have a problem. So just something I wanted to drop in there, but Glenn's right on the money with that.
John, I think you're onto something here, and I think Joe has given us a hint of it. I'll see if I can confirm this with Glenn. We know now that tantalums have got an aging characteristic, depending on how much overvoltage they're rated for, depending on how much temperature they're being subjected to, depending how much current ripple they're being subjected to, you got all kinds of aging characteristics. I'm now beginning to think that as a tantalum capacitor ages, that the true voltage rating slowly comes down with age. You can artificially age it more rapidly with temperature, high voltage, high current, whatever, which is not, all of these are mechanisms of making temperature. So real temperature subjected to the capacitor and real aging, I'm guessing from what John has just told us and what Joe has experienced, that the true voltage rating is coming down. And therefore, in other words, you're standing in this elevator and the ceiling is slowly descending and it's eventually going to hit you in the head as far as an analogy is concerned. Is that possibly what's going on here, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, that's pretty much a lot of the case. In most instances, especially with power circuits and power supplies, the you know, capacitors have a lifespan, and you know, beyond that certain load life, when they're used, they do wear out. But there are ways to size them. And as I said, you know, you can always get capacitors with higher temperature ratings, higher voltage ratings, and higher ripple current ratings. And if you pay attention to the graphs and look at those capacitors, you can put them in there and probably put a design a capacitor in it, and it'll outlast your lifetime. So, here again, when those numbers start, most capacitors, when they start really having trouble, is when they're designed close to their design limit. And I think that's what happens with a lot of manufacturers, because in order to save cost, what they're doing is they don't really want their product to last, you know, 15, 20 years. They want to, you know, put something out there at market that's going to last, you know, get them past their warranty period. But when they start dealing with the industrial and the military, they have to meet warranty periods. And if they don't, they're going to get a lot of returns. But then again, people in the commercial consumer market, if they don't play their game right, they're going to get a lot of returns as well.
So you can always size the capacitor to last a long time, but it does, you know, require a little looking into those data sheets, Dick.
This is KEY.
Mel recognized. We're going to go to Wesley first. We're getting a lot of information here that normally is not taught in the schools, in my opinion. At least it wasn't taught in the schools that I've gone to. And it's the voice of experience you guys are hearing. There's a whole lot of hidden information. And that very innocent-looking capacitor we've all been taking for granted up till now. Wow. A lot more is going on. N2XJN, go right ahead with your question or comment, Wes. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, N2XJN, thank you. I have a problem with advanced mathematics. 2,000 hours, it would want 7,000 hours. I believe we should go a little bit deeper into the generalization of the capacitors. And then I have a few questions to Glenn. The ceramic capacitors are not necessarily matching the capacitance of the let's say tantalum peroxide, pentoxide capacitor. So the energy stored in the capacitor is the energy required to move the stored charge through the potential of the capacitor. The capacitance of the device depends mostly on the plate geometry and the nature of the dielectric. And it is directly proportional to the direction constant and inversely proportional to the thickness of the dielectric, with especially pointed thickness of the dielectric. So let's go to the certain table. The electric constant of air or vacuum is 1, polypropylene is 2.2, polyester is 3, mica is 6, aluminium oxide is 8.5, and tantalum pentoxide is 27. Then we have niobium oxide 41 and barium, which is 1,000 to 10,000. Now, as the charge and the voltage on the given capacitor are increased, at the some point, the dielectric will no longer be able to insulate the charges from each other, and the dielectric then inhibits the dielectric breakdown or the high conductivity in some areas, which tends to lower the stored energy and charge, generating the internal heat. Of course, Glenn mentioned that he let me up. And he mentioned this phenomenon that is undesirable in the most of the capacitor application. And it occurs that the capacitor breakdowns at the capacitor breakdown voltage. So the capacitor damage or destruction can occur in such a situation. And normally the breakdown ratings for the dielectric are expressed at the maximum strength, which is basically the ratio of the applied voltage to the dielectric thickness. Question of mine is, why don't we double or triple the dielectric thickness in order to prevent to make the life of the capacitor longer? That's the one. And the second one, I recall 2,000 hours versus, let's say, 27 years old capacitor of the same kind, and it's still working and was always in the same device. Something must be that I do not understand in this area. And I would like to know, chemically, what is going on in the process of ordering or the breakdown in the tantalum pentoxide capacitor? But this.
In a case of increasing the spacing between the plates of a capacitor to increase the dielectric strength, the high voltage rating, you're absolutely right. You increase the spacing and it can tolerate higher voltage. But every time you double the spacing, you've got half the capacitor. Think you have designed a 10 microfarad capacitor, and now it's a 2.5 microfarad capacitor because you've made the spacing four times bigger.
I have a problem with that because you can increase the height of the device, not necessarily the thickness of the device. You have plenty of room to play with.
Can I answer that one?
Now, the bottom line is we're discussing volume. No matter what you do to increase the spacing of the dielectric material, the same number of microfarads is going to be that increase in overall volume, is my guess. Over to you, Glenn.
And you got physical restraints.
Yes, Wesley, that's the whole crux of the whole discussion here with capacitors. And when you start looking at the size of capacitors, if I were to show somebody a 25-volt capacitor at 1,000 microfarads, I can show you ones that are basically look like, you know, they're only maybe 5 millimeters across and maybe no more than like 7 millimeters tall. But I can also show you the same exact value of capacitor that's 25 millimeters tall and 25 millimeters in diameter. And you'd be like, my goodness, how could those two capacitors have the same exact ratings? The key is life, and it's your ability to design. If you have to shrink a lot of circuitry in a very, very small area, people don't want to use the big components. As a matter of fact, my mechanical designers, whenever I work with them and I start to make things more robust, they're trying to shrink me down in size. But most of my customers want to shrink me down in size. But you're right, if you want to make something big and robust, it's going to be large and cool. But if it's going to be small and hot, you know, you got to really dot your I's and cross your T's. Let me test back to that. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, Wes did have one other question. Does any of us explain tantalum pentoxide or whatever it was, the failure mechanism in there? He wants to know. I'd like to know. And I think this is a little bit on the esoteric side. But if you happen to know, tell us the secret, Glenn. You got it, Glenn.
Well, I don't think that there's any secret here, Dick. Basically, what happens when a voltage is exceeded? Now, at room temperature, if the static voltage is increased beyond the dielectric capability, you get an arc, and that arc inside makes a carbon path right through the dielectric, and it destroys your capacitor right there. So, I mean, now you've got a resistance across your capacitor, and depending on the density of the W material, like inside a tantalum, if you have a carbon arc that runs right through the center of that solid material, it really just wrecks and destroys it one quick shot. So that's basically it. It's an arc and a carbon trace running right through the center. Back to you, K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Question. Any questions?
Yeah, we're going to get to John next. Boy, I had a question. I'm going to go over to John. I mean, here we go. Mel, K2KEY, you've worked on a lot of power supplies that have had to have high reliability because of your particular surveillance circuitry and whatever. What have you heard, and I know you've got some comments on this, but I'd also like to know if you can throw in what you've learned in all your years of experience of what you do to make capacitors reliable. K2KEY. Sounding good, Mel. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, believe it or not, I say I'm sort of breathing a little bit easier by quite a week. I won't go into any more than that, but it was quite a challenge to get through this week. You know what surprises me? I have so much equipment, test equipment. This stuff is, some of it is really antique, tool package, electronics, etc. The stuff was on from morning till day. And much of it is still in excellent working order. As far as the power supplies that we use, they were commercial made power supplies by a company out in the Long Island. I think it was a company called T, you know, at China. Well, there was Raytheon, there was Lambda, and there was one other company, I think. Anyway, never had a power failure. Never had really a power supply failure. They ran things night and day, these things. Everything was on 24, and it never seemed to have any real failures. So I was, completely taken back by hearing some of these comments about failures. Let me drop. I want to make one more comment. My mother had in the kitchen a radio sitting on a shelf that she played from morning till night. Boy, year and year and year and year and now. Oh, boy. 5-tube radio. It's about, no doubt, I'll bet you 20-plus years. Got to have a hum. I said, Mama, I'll fix this boy. I'll need to fix it. So they put a new filter, 50, 30, 150, filter capacitor into it. And the thing just went back to its normal life. And I took the old capacitor. I remember I put it open. And the only thing it was dried out in there. I don't know. Did we go backwards? That stuff like that, all that old electronics seems to go on and on and on, and now we're having failures 2,000 hours. There's something going crazy here, over.
Yeah, the old electrolytic capacitors of the 30, 50, 150 microfarad rating that were part of the power supplies of tube radios of yesteryear. They had what looked like a paper outside and had some kind of a glue-like substance on the end, and very similar to the AC electrolytic capacitors that are used in Cornell Dubilier, Ham-M, and AR-22-type rotators. When they dry out, the 100 and some-odd microfarads go down to a small fraction of a microfarad real fast. The stuff inside the juice has got to be wet, and otherwise it doesn't have the dielectric constant, and you don't have the microfarads you want. But one of the questions, we're going to have to move on because we promised Dave that he's not going to have to wait too long, but one last question for you, Dave, Glenn, is that during the aging process of temperature, is there any way we can find out where does the chemistry go? In other words, does the tantalum fail because the juice evaporates or because the right chemistry is there, but it moves into the wrong position? In the case of a lead-acid battery, a LiPo battery, on the 500th time that I've charged it and discharged it, if it was well-sealed to begin with, all the original stuff is still there, but it has migrated to the wrong place and the wrong grain size and whatever, and we're now unhappy with the ampere hours we got. Is there something similar going on with the tantalum that's well-sealed? I mean, some of these quality tantalum capacitors have got beautiful glass seals on the end. I'd like to believe that they're essentially a hermetic seal, and they shouldn't be drying out. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
That's precisely right, Dick. It is an electrolyte that's between the aluminum plates and the dielectric itself. But which one of the things that you have to keep in mind, and maybe Mel didn't catch the whole discussion about 2,000-hour load life. 2,000-hour load life is at max. Let's say if the capacitor has an 85 degree C rating, and it has a 10 volt rating, and a 1 ampere or 1,000 milliamp or 1 amp ripple current rating. Now, if you were to run that capacitor at just under the 10 volts, so 9.99, and run the ripple current right up to 1 amp RMS, and you were to run it at 85 degrees C, you will have capacitors start to fail. In a statistical group, you'll have capacitors start to fail at 2,000 hours due to evaporation and degradation of the electrolyte. If you were to back off the temperature, if you back off the ripple current and you back off the voltage, all three of those items, that load life goes way up from 2,000. It goes up in some cases exponentially. Usually the key thing is to derate by 70%. I can demonstrate a 2,000-hour capacitor with 100,000 hours of load life by just keeping everything to, let's say, one-half of its rating. So if I just, half the temperature, so if it's 105, don't run it above 50 degrees C, half the voltage, half the ripple current, that's going to last like 100,000 hours. So that's how you get things to last a long time. K2RIW, K22QIQ.
I thank you, Glenn. Valuable information. Wesley, I'm going to pass it over, and normally you ask about 5 questions. We're going to the deeper section. You can go back and do that. But we promised Dave we're going to not keep him more than an hour, so try to be brief on this one now, Wes, and then we can come back to it. Into XJM, K2RIW.
There's going to be only one question. The mass energy density of the capacitor is the ratio between the amount of the energy the capacitor can store at its working voltage to the capacitor mass, including the package. And the working voltage of the capacitor is defined as the maximum rated voltage for the given application. So the working voltage is generally less than breakdown voltage. Now what Glenn said is that he said that he would keep it half of the maximum rating. And, of course, if we talk about the exception to this rule that will occur if the transient peak voltage is able to exceed the steady state breakout voltage. As long as we don't have that condition, the volumetric energy density of the capacitor is defined as the ratio of the energy stored to the capacitor volume, including the package. My question then is, why though